This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's behind the escalating tensions between Iran and the United States? Does Iran pose an imminent threat to U.S. interests? Or is the Trump administration exaggerating intelligence to lay the groundwork for war? Does the Trump administration want negotiation or confrontation? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. It was inevitable that a more adversarial relationship between Washington and Tehran would ensue from the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran Nuclear Accord, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, exactly 1 year ago. U.S. President Donald Trump had consistently railed against this agreement, which was negotiated under the Obama administration and endorsed by six world powers and Iran in 2015. The agreement placed strict limits on Iran's nuclear program in return for sanctions relief and allowed international inspectors to gain extensive access to monitor compliance. Since then, the Trump administration has applied fresh sanctions to cut off Iran's oil and banking sectors in an attempt to alter Tehran's behavior and force it to renegotiate a stronger deal. In another move to squeeze the Islamic Republic, in April, Washington officially designated Iran's military unit, the International Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, as a terrorist organization. The unprecedented move garnered swift reaction from critics, as well as the Iranian government, which subsequently labeled the U.S. a terrorism supporter and CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, a terrorist group. Some analysts believe that hardliners in the U.S. administration, such as National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, would like to topple the regime and may want to goad Iran into war through a series of provocative moves. Meantime, Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, has threatened that Tehran would stop complying with parts of the nuclear deal and warned that more breaches might follow. His announcement came after the United States earlier this month sent an aircraft carrier strike group and bombers to the Middle East in response to alleged indications of Iranian aggression. Top Pentagon officials will provide President Trump with a range of options in response to rising tensions, including possibly sending thousands more U.S. troops to the region. Analysts say that the combination of a dissolving nuclear agreement and more saber rattling increases the risk that America and Iran will stumble into war, whether by accident or design. Well, joining us to discuss the ramifications of rising tensions between Washington and Tehran are two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Gerald Feierstein is a senior vice president at the Middle East Institute, a prominent Washington think tank. A senior career diplomat with 41 years of experience, Ambassador Feierstein served in 9 overseas postings, including Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Yemen, where he was U.S. ambassador from 2010 to 2013. And Nicholas Harris, he's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington-based global research and analysis institute. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you today.
Thank you for having us.
Ambassador Feierstein, let me begin with you. Where do you stand on the intelligence that has led to a buildup of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf region and a drawdown of U.S. diplomats in Iraq? In other words, notwithstanding Iran's normal hegemonic behavior in Syria, Iraq, or Yemen, do you believe that photographs of Iranians loading missiles onto small boats and other alleged acts indicate that Iran is ready to strike, or is it responding defensively to economic pressure from the Trump administration, sanctions, and the perception maybe that the White House is, in a sense, eager for a fight?
Well, it's hard to say, Carol, exactly what the intelligence shows. The Secretary of State Pompeo and the Acting Secretary of Defense Shanahan went up to the Hill to brief members about what they had in the way of intelligence to try to explain what the rationale was for the administration's actions. We know that there have been these references to putting missiles onto small patrol sailboats. Almost certainly there is some intelligence out there that demonstrates that the Iranians are improving their posture for a possible confrontation with the U.S. But whether it goes beyond the kinds of actions that we've seen in the past, whether it really is sufficient to have triggered the kind of response we've seen from Washington is a little bit unclear.
Turning to you, Nicholas Harris, for your interpretation of these tensions, and to what extent is Iran responding defensively, or is Washington responding in terms of deterrence from what they perceive as Iran's bellicose actions?
You know, Carol, tensions between the United States and Iran have been increased steadily since President Trump's decision last year to remove the United States from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called nuclear deal. There's always been sort of this tension in the U.S. approach to Iran going back to the embassy crisis in 1979, 1980. You know, this current situation is tenuous because both sides, Iran and the United States, seem to be following a strategy of escalation to de-escalate. Fundamentally, the United States has imposed a vice on Iran's economy. The Trump administration has made it very clear in its 12 points that Secretary Pompeo briefed last year that it is no longer disassociating Iran's regional activities and its ballistic missile production from the discrete issue of Iran's nuclear weapons program. If you look at those 12 points, fundamentally what the Trump administration is saying is that Iran is not allowed to have even a peaceful domestic nuclear capability for power generation, that it must withdraw all of its support for all of its proxies or partner organizations throughout the region, and it has to stop ballistic missile research and production. From Iran's perspective, its ability to have a domestic civil nuclear program is vital for its economic growth and for its national pride. Its ability to have partners and proxies throughout the region allows it to have strategic deterrence against its opponents, notably Israel and Saudi Arabia, but also the United States. And its ability to have ballistic missiles for purposes of defense allows it to even the playing field, so to speak, vis-a-vis the Israelis and the Gulf Arab states that have advanced technologies that they can wield against it. And this current moment is very tenuous because the action that the Trump administration has taken seems to indicate that it has a broader strategy than just contain Iran, that it may also seek to take actions that could eventually lead to the downfall of the regime.
Well, that's a very good point, and I want to ask Ambassador Feierstein about that very point. You mentioned Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's 12 points, conditions in order to renegotiate with Iran. These are very stringent conditions. No one believes that Iran would agree to them. So, Ambassador Feierstein, it appears that the administration's theory behind withdrawing from the nuclear deal, setting out these very stringent conditions, and imposing oil sanctions, now sanctions on the metal industry, all of which are devastating Iran's economy and hurting ordinary Iranians, and of course branding the IRGC a terrorist organization, is that somehow Iran would capitulate and be forced to renegotiate the nuclear deal, or that somehow the Iranian people would rise up and overthrow the regime. Is that a realistic approach? Is that, in your view, what is driving the administration, or at least the hardliners in it?
Again, there is not a clear position that the administration has taken. And I think that even the Iranians, when Javad Zarif was here a couple of weeks ago in New York,
the Iranian foreign minister
made the assertion that he and the Iranian regime see a difference within the U.S. administration in terms of what they want. And their view is that Donald Trump thinks that he is going to force the Iranians back to the negotiating table in order to provide the kinds of changes in the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, that he demanded when he was on the campaign trail in 2016. But on the other hand, they believe that people like John Bolton and some of the other hardliners in the administration actually see this policy of maximum pressure as a way, precisely as you identified, of either forcing regime change or as a prelude to a military intervention with Iran. So the inability of the administration to clearly articulate what its strategy is and what its end state is has led to a massive confusion both in the United States and around the world.
Turning back to you, Nicholas Harris, about the division in the administration between the so-called hardliners like John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, on the one hand, and then Mr. Trump and perhaps the Pentagon in the lesser hardline category. How do these divisions undermine U.S. credibility and leverage in the region?
Well, I would agree with Ambassador Feierstein that these divisions are out there and they're in the open. And the challenge is the United States has this maximum pressure strategy. And as we have identified, the overriding question is, to what end exactly are you seeking? You've set out these very maximal demands with the 12 points that Secretary Pompeo unveiled last year. You have Secretary Pompeo say in a podcast with former Deputy CIA Director Mike Morrell that, you know, he wants the Iranian people essentially to rise up and change their government. And you have John Bolton come out with some pretty strong language. At the same time, President Trump sort of says no, he wants a deal, but then he says Iran will suffer massive consequences. The Department of Defense is more cautious, but it's ready to go into action. And on the other flip side, you do have a lot of exposure of U.S. interests and assets in the broader Middle East to Iranian proxy or partner activities or Iranian military activities. So the situation is tenuous. I would say that the signal that I get is that the one point that the administration agrees on is that it wants to look tougher than the Obama administration was, and that they reject the worldview that you can separate the nuclear issue from all these other issues. Now the question is, all these other issues, ballistic missiles and Iran's support for proxies and partners in the region, are part of Iran's national security strategy. So fundamentally, what the administration is saying is it will use maximum economic pressure to either force regime change or alternatively force the regime to bottle itself up within Iran's borders and face a slow decay.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Gerald Feierstein. He's former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, currently senior vice president at the Middle East Institute. And Nicholas Harris, from whom you just heard. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security. We're discussing the roots and ramifications of the rising tensions between Iran and the United States. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Mfana Sebi Kulu from KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter at voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to our discussion on the tensions between the United States and Iran. So back to you, Ambassador Feierstein. I just want to put a little bit of historical context in here. We have to remember that the United States led invasion of Iraq back in 2003, a number of other policies and actions on the part of the United States, in a sense, emboldened Iran. We sort of ceded ground. We didn't maybe pay enough attention after we liberated, one could say, Iraq. It allowed Iran to gain much more influence in the region. But anyway, that's just another point. Do you think that the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, would bow to economic pressure and international isolation and agree to negotiate at some point? Can you imagine that scenario that Mr. Trump would like to produce?
I think that it is a possibility. I don't think we can rule it out. Khamenei, in recent comments that were reported in the Iranian press, had referred to negotiating with Donald Trump as poison. People have pointed out that that's exactly the same terminology that was used in 1988 when the Iranians agreed to negotiations with Iraq to end the Iran-Iraq war. And so I think that there might be a window whereby the Iranians would decide that it is better to try to work out a deal with Donald Trump than it would be to continue to suffer under these extreme economic pressures. I think, and I agree with Nick, that the 12 points that Mike Pompeo laid out in his statement about negotiating with Iran are really not negotiating points. This is not the kind of demands that you would put on the table if you were serious about trying to reach an agreement. It was a demand for capitulation. And so I don't see that there would be any potential for negotiating on the basis of that. But there's also the history of Donald Trump, and people look at the way he approached the North Koreans. And the same kind of extreme demands, the same kind of threats that the administration used against the North Koreans and then turned around immediately and began a negotiating process. You can't rule out that the same strategy might be attempted with the Iranians.
On the other hand, Nicholas Harris, many critics would argue that Iran is not North Korea. It's a different animal. But do you see any kind of potential for the supreme leader, who is really the ultimate arbiter in Iran or the IRGC, to bow to this very draconian economic pressure and international isolation and, in a sense, come back to the negotiating table?
Carol, in many ways, that's sort of the billion-dollar question. What is the assessment of the supreme leader and the inner core of Iran's regime, including the IRGC, about the extent to which it can negotiate with the Donald Trump administration? And you get mixed signals. On the one hand, as Ambassador Feierstein laid out beautifully, there's this history of the narrative of resistance that the Iranians have. But when forced to, they've made painful compromises. On the other hand, there's a challenge embedded in that because it seems that the Iranian leadership believes that it can weather this current storm, that it can survive the economic shock that the United States is applying to it, and that it can try to wait out the Trump administration and hope that a future Democratic administration will be more amenable to relieving some of the sanctions pressure. I think there's a really interesting escalation ladder that's going on right now. You see in the comments from Foreign Minister Zarif and Iran's President Hassan Rouhani, I mean, their pitch isn't to the United States. Their pitch is to the Europeans and to the Chinese and to the Russians. They're turning to the other members of the so-called P5+1, the global powers that first negotiated the nuclear deal with Iran, and saying, look, we have our own grievances. We are the aggrieved party here. The United States unilaterally walked out of this agreement. But even before the United States walked out, the economic benefits that we were supposed to obtain from agreeing to limit in our nuclear program haven't reached us. You hear a lot of discussion now from the Iranian leadership about what are these so-called gains that we were supposed to make from it. The Supreme Leader Khamenei says it directly and bluntly, that he advised against this deal and didn't expect to receive any benefits, but he wanted to try it to see what would happen. Now that there haven't been benefits, this question moving forward is, if there is a change in the U.S. administration in 2021, would a hypothetical Democratic administration actually be able to walk back into the JCPOA as it is? Or would it actually have to now set the stage for a sort of JCPOA plus, that the bare minimum include ballistic missiles or regional activities?
So, Ambassador Feierstein, in terms of the JCPOA and the Europeans are trying to desperately keep the nuclear accord alive, but it doesn't look like it can survive. What are the implications if it in fact falls apart?
It's a good question, and I think that it depends on exactly what you mean by if it falls apart. Do you mean that Iran resumes its nuclear weapons activities? That's a possibility. They're talking now about perhaps walking away from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have already said that they're going to resume at least low-level uranium enrichment and begin to start up some more of their centrifuges again. So do they maintain that kind of level of activity, or do they go back to full-fledged pursuit of a nuclear weapons program? And that would have serious detrimental implications for the future stability of the region. It would probably trigger a nuclear arms race with Saudi Arabia, among others. It would intensify the potential for conflict between Iran and Israel, which is already in a serious situation because of Iranian intervention and presence in Syria that's very threatening to Israel. And of course, it might also have implications for other tangential issues like the Yemen conflict, where, again, if Iran wanted to increase the pressure on Saudi Arabia, they could very easily use the Houthis in Yemen in order to increase pressure on the Saudis. And we're already seeing some signs of that. So there are a number of ways that if the Iranians decide to abandon the nuclear deal and to demonstrate how they can be spoilers in the region, there are a lot of areas where they have potential to cause a lot of difficulty for the United States and our partners.
Nicholas Harris, how do you see the implications?
The question is Iran going to trust the international community? It is now in a position of sort of a resistance crouch. It has so many different ways that it can affect the global economy by trying to close down the Strait of Hormuz or the Bab al-Mandeb off the coast of Yemen. It can use its proxies. It can use its agents in Europe to strike at dissidents. It can send Afghani refugees towards Europe via Turkey, which is a topic that's come up in recent days. There's a lot of sort of different sort of asymmetric gray zone type of activities that Iran can utilize to strike at its enemies. And fundamentally, though, the question is, do any of those activities relieve the economic pressure that is occurring in Iran now? And does that economic pressure exacerbate what we've already seen, which is an organic sort of protest movement that has evolved in Iran's sort of medium and small cities and its rural areas? I think that the Iranian leadership is going to have to address, which is, to what extent can it continue to have a sort of aggressive posture regionally in the light of its own internal challenges? And the Europeans and the Chinese and the Russians in particular are going to have to start questioning whether they're willing to make trade-offs or to suffer the wrath of the United States in order to break some of these sanctions. Because if they don't relieve that economic pressure on Iran, there's all these second and third order effects that could have damaging consequences for their own economies and the global economy.
Either way, the scenarios you paint are very bleak and don't really lead to anything but chaos and potential miscalculation. So, Ambassador Feierstein, what about a diplomatic strategy to engage Iran like the United States did vis-a-vis North Korea? You brought that up. Could perhaps Oman, which is seen as a bridge between Iran and the United States, could they play a constructive role?
Sure. And we've seen in recent days, the president himself has talked about perhaps asking the Swiss, who are protecting power in Tehran, if they would be interested in helping to open a channel of communications with the Iranians. The Omanis are always available, and there have been some conversations with the Omanis about that possibility as well. There are others. The Kuwaitis in the past been used as intermediaries between the GCC and Tehran. So if the president decides that he wants to try to pursue a negotiating strategy, that his policy of maximum pressure is succeeding in forcing the Iranians to come back to the negotiating table, then he can do that. But I think it goes back to a point that Nicholas made early on in the conversation, and that is, in a sense, the administration has boxed itself into a corner by adopting a posture that demands that whatever comes out of this, it has to be better than what Barack Obama had. And in many ways, that's their biggest difficulty, is that they cannot negotiate an agreement that could be interpreted by others as being more the same of the kinds of agreements that Obama got through the Iran nuclear deal negotiations.
Well, Nicholas, you get the last word. Do you see a diplomatic off-ramp? How do you see this playing out in a more constructive and peaceful way rather than in an escalatory military fashion?
The irony is there's a sense that we don't have any more time and that the situation is about to explode. But I actually think that if the Trump administration plays its cards right, it can try to move to limit Iran's ability to project power regionally. And we've seen this with its sanctions policy. Maximum pressure has had an impact on Lebanese Hezbollah. It could have an impact on how Iraqi proxies or partners of Iran situate themselves. And over time, through the UN process, it could reduce the power of the Houthis. I think that a diplomatic breakthrough, honestly, will occur after the 2020 election. If Iran sees that the Trump administration has won its second term, you may see more amenable actions to engage in with the Americans, perhaps through the Omani channel, perhaps through the Swiss channel, perhaps through other means, and have that direct sort of contact and conduit that's needed. If it's a Democratic candidate that wins, I think the big question will be this. Can the United States, having walked out of the JCPOA, and possibly having Iran walk out of the JCPOA in the interim period, can it develop an international consensus to form a sort of coalition like the P5 plus one to re-engage the Iranians? Because the bare minimum that the general public will accept is something more than the original JCPOA.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Gerald Feierstein. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, currently Senior Vice President at the Middle East Institute, and Nicholas Harris, Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks so much, gentlemen, for your terrific insights.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Carol.
Pleasure. Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Rob McLean. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.